you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome. As many of you know, if you are a regular listener, for most of the summer, we've been doing something a little bit different. First, I was putting together sort of compilations of old commentaries that were behind the paywall at my Patreon site, which if you are interested in becoming a sustainer and patron of the show, you can do that, I should point out, at patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can help sustain the show at $1 a month, $2 a month, $5, $10, $20, whatever you can do. And the more you give, the more bonus content you are eligible for. In addition to that, putting together some of those old commentaries, had also put together some new extended commentaries, 50-minute to one-hour long programs where it's been just me talking about a particular issue. Last week, I was talking about the issue of free speech, and particularly as it relates to the college campus and to what extent schools ought to have the right and or responsibility to restrict access when it comes to outside speakers to people who are white nationalists, for example, or right-wing, hateful, bigoted, misogynistic, Islamophobic, whatever the case might be. And so I went through sort of all the arguments that one hears on that subject. If you haven't had a chance to listen to that show, by all means, go and give that a listen. And then within a few weeks, the goal is to get back into the swing of interviewing folks as guests on the show. One of the great highlights of the last year for me has been having the conversations that I've been fortunate enough to have with amazing activists, organizers, scholars, folks in media, just incredible people, mostly younger people than myself, younger folks of color around the country doing wonderful stuff, and white folks too. Don't want to slight the white folks. I get accused of that more than enough already. All the folks I've had on, just fantastic shows. I hope you'll go back and listen to the archive. I do want to get back into the swing of that. Was taking a break during the summer. Now that I am back, headed out on the road, actually having a relatively heavy August and September, I'm not going to make any promises as to when that will happen. I am going to try very hard over the course of the next several weeks to get a show out every week, although probably, just to give you a heads up, beginning around October, which may very well be the point at which I begin to interview people again, probably going to be transitioning into a twice a month program. Would love to be able to do it once a week. I just have to tell you, with the limited time time that I have on the road and just a very minimal budget, really essentially non-existent budget, we just really don't have the money to do a weekly show. It's just impossible. You know, it's impossible. But we are going to try to do it at least every other week because we do have a loyal listener base out there. And we want to make sure that those of you who've been with us the whole time, or maybe you've just joined, continue to have good quality programming. So I promise we're going to get back into the swing of interviewing folks, because that really is the purpose of this program, is to uplift the voices of others, not simply to run my own mouth, and particularly to uplift the voices of people of color, which is what I've been trying to do for a year. For today, what I wanted to do was talk about something that I have been wanting to address either in an extended commentary on Patreon or in a regular show, because I think folks will find it helpful, particularly for those of you out there who are activists or organizers of some kind, or really just anyone who is engaged in political dialogue, debate, or discussion with anyone. It could be a roommate in college, it could be a friend, a colleague, a family member, the ubiquitous uncle at Thanksgiving dinner kind of thing, right? Because I always get that question, what can I say to my uncle who, you know, and then this uncle tends to be horribly racist and horribly sexist and say awful things about Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, whatever, about socialism, about Bernie, about the left, and, you know, believes in the QAnon conspiracy or whatever other nonsense, listens to Alex Jones. And so people always sort of want to know, like, how do we respond to the other side? I mean, just the other day, I was speaking in New Orleans at Loyola University and also at a church uptown in the city. And in both of the events, the community event and the Loyola University event, one of the questions that came up was, you know, how do we talk to people who are not in this room right now? In other words, how do we talk to people who are not the choir? And usually when people say that, they mean, how do we talk to people whose views are just like diametrically opposed to ours? Now, there's a certain way of answering that, which is, well, I'm not sure why you're wasting your time with someone who's diametrically opposed to you. You know, like, I don't encourage anti-racists to go out and try to convert the Klan members, right, and neo-Nazis. If you're able to somehow connect with those folks and help bring them out of that life, that's wonderful. There are certainly people like my friend Christian Picciolini who do that, and I think that's great. And I know a lot of Frankie Mink and Scott Shepard and Arno Michaelis, you know, folks who are former white power skinheads, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, Klansmen, and they have come out of that life, and they help other people get out of that life. And that's fabulous, and I wish them all the best, and I try to hold up their work. I've had Christian on the show before. But I don't really think that for most of us that is the most logical thing that we could be doing with our time. I tend to think that we, you know, rather than trying to convert the heathen, so to speak, and take someone who's really locked into that life and bring them out, we ought to be mobilizing our side and focusing more on that. I think if I were Christian or Arno or Frankie or Scott Shepard or any of those folks who have come out of hate movements, I would certainly be involved in what they're involved in because they know that life. It's like if I was a former gang member, I think I would definitely be very invested in helping other people leave gangs precisely because I know why they're there. I know what brought them in, and I have a sense of what might bring them out because I know what brought me out. So that is a calling, man. That is something that if you have been in that life, you ought to be doing that. But for the vast majority of us who have not been in that life, whether that life is the white power movement, whether that life is a street gang of one type or another, there's probably a better way to use most of our time. That said, how do we do it? Because there is sort of this debate, and there are two schools of thought about how one deals with people who are not where you are. They don't necessarily have to be diametrically opposed, but just people who are not where you are on various issues, political issues. How do you persuade people during an election to vote for candidate X as opposed to candidate Y? Whatever the case might be. And the schools of thought on this, the first, and probably, you know, for many, many years, the most prominent, really reaches back to Enlightenment theory, so we're talking a very long trajectory and long shelf life here, is this notion that reason, that analysis, that fact, that rationality is the currency of politics. And those who do a better job communicating factual information and reality and reason will ultimately carry the day. This is not only an argument used within the realm of electoral politics, it is an argument to which I alluded last week in the free speech discussion when I noted how sort of traditional liberal argumentation around free speech, the kind of argument that the ACLU makes, for instance, and that others make when they say, that we really shouldn't have any limitations on something like hate speech, one of the arguments they make is that we need to have an open marketplace of ideas. And in a truly open marketplace of ideas, the more voices there are, the better the likelihood that truth will out, that the best arguments will win, that we will be able to discern truth once we have this open marketplace of ideas. And as I explained last week, it's sort of a naive position, but it is one that is very common. It is part of the whole notion of the Enlightenment and the notion of rationality and reason over pure faith and superstition, this notion that rationality will ultimately carry the day. It's something we want to believe, I think. It's something that we don't have a lot of evidence for historically. So I want to talk a little bit about that issue. Do facts matter? Does reason matter? Does rationality matter? If so, how? If not, why not? And the reason I want to do this is because I think if we're going to be effective as political activists, organizers, candidates for office, or people simply supporting candidates for office, we do need to have an understanding of how persuasion works. What is persuasive? What is not persuasive? And why? And understanding sort of the psychology of it in a way that can make us more effective. And I have to say, you know, it was very hard for me to come to a place where I could accept the idea that maybe facts and rationality and analysis and reason don't necessarily matter, or at least not as much as we've been given to believe. I had a hard time accepting that. I think a lot of liberal and left-leaning people in particular do, because as I've long said, I think liberalism and sort of people on the left are given to this sort of unnatural, unjustifiable faith in the power of pure reason that can sometimes lead us astray. I know that for me, from a very early age, I was given to argumentation and sort of the art of argumentation. I grew up in a home where my father and mother were both, you know, they weren't like activists, but they were certainly very political. They had very strong opinions. They were both very liberal and also just a very verbal household, right? Just a household where a very high premium was placed on oral communication. My father was for most of his life an actor and a stand-up comic, which is to say he was sort of always on stage performing, you know, whether that was literally performing or whether that was just making dinner and then performing in the home. He was sort of always on. And so there was a very high premium placed on the spoken word and being able to think very quickly on one's feet. And so from an early age, I was doing that. And I came to believe that argument was really this very high calling and that facts mattered because facts were how you won arguments, right? When I got into high school and I became a debater, facts were very important. It was about researching. It was about finding the best evidence for your position. It was about articulating the most logical position. Later, when I became an activist, I always thought it was very important to memorize as much information, just to know as much stuff as I possibly could. But what I came to appreciate and to understand once I was an activist and trying to deploy all of these facts and all of this information was that facts and analysis don't really matter a lot. And I have three stories that sort of illustrate the point. When I graduated from college, as most of you know, the first thing that I did professionally was I worked in the campaigns against David Duke, former Klan leader, lifelong white supremacist and neo-Nazi, who was running for the U.S. Senate in Louisiana in 1990 and then governor in 91. And I started out as the youth coordinator for the primary anti-Duke organization and then later went on to be associate director. During that first campaign, so now we're talking about the U.S. Senate campaign, one of the things I did, I traveled along with journalist Jason Berry, who was one of the other people that was actively involved in the anti-Duke work at the time. We went to Lafayette together. He was speaking at what was then called USL, University of Southwestern Louisiana. Now it's University of Louisiana at Lafayette. So he was speaking and I was going to go and sort of table at the event. So I was going to bring literature from our coalition and I was going to staff the table and get signatures and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. And of course, a number of Duke's supporters showed up to the event to ask Jason all these, you know, what they considered, I guess, to be very tough questions or to just give him a hard time. And at one point near the end, I was engaged in a conversation with some of these Duke people. And one of the pieces of literature that we at the coalition had put out at that point, which had been a paper, about a 16 or 17 pages, I remember, paper that our director, Lance Hill, who was a graduate student, who was doing a bunch of sort of academic research that ultimately was published in a book, an academic journal article about Duke. He had written this 16 or 17 or whatever it was page paper about the similarities between David Duke's philosophies going back to his days in the Klan and then when he formed the National Association for the Advancement of White People, the similarities between his philosophies, especially around population genetics and eugenic population control programs, the sterilization of quote unquote inferior people and the subsidizing of births for quote unquote superior people, the similarities between his views on that and Hitler's views. And among the things Lance had done is he'd gone back and he had found things in Mein Kampf about his views on population genetics. And then he found things that Duke had said that were, you know, virtually verbatim. And you could actually mix and match these quotes and you wouldn't necessarily know whether Hitler had said it or Duke had said it. That's how similar it was. And so as a very effective, you know, academic kind of paper, not necessarily the kind of thing that you're going to, you know, send to the newspaper as a press release. It's a little academic and scholarly for that, but it was just an interesting way to ground an understanding of David Duke's racial ideology and to recognize how comparable it was to the philosophies of Hitlerism and ultimately German National Socialism when it came to race. And so we get in this argument, and there was one of the Duke people confronted me. Somebody else was talking to Jason, and one of the Duke people confronted me and said, "Well, how is Duke a Nazi?" Now, you know, the reality is, you know, we had pictures of the guy wearing a swastika. One of his primary campaign managers in 1988, when he had run briefly for president, was a former member of the American Nazi Party. He had direct connections to Nazism that we could have drawn in terms of his associates, in terms of things that he had said praising George Lincoln Rockwell, the founder of the American Nazi Party, who was assassinated in 1967. You know, the fact that David had been selling Nazi materials, denying the Holocaust and praising Hitler from the basement of his house, which also doubled as his state legislative office when he was in the state legislature. We had all of this, you know, pretty clear visual information. But rather than get into that, I decided that I would go all factual and analytical on this guy's ass. And so I start explaining, taking this right out of Lance's paper about sort of the ideological underpinnings of Duke's racial hygiene theories, I start explaining, well, you know, that Duke is really articulating the second phase of German National Socialism. And I go into this long historical exegetical discussion about how, well, you know, Nazism had these various phases and he's not at phase three, which is the genocidal extermination phase. He's sort of in phase two. And of course, all of this is true. All of this is documented in Lance's paper. But, you know, you can imagine it did not have an effect on the person to whom I was speaking. That was my first indication that facts don't necessarily matter and certainly not deep scholarly analysis. It might be interesting. It might be persuasive at a scholarly conference, but that shit is not going to work on the street and it's not going to work in an electoral campaign. Okay, moving along. In 1996, I am working with a nonprofit group in the city that does children's advocacy, and I'm an organizer in public housing, and I'm also doing public policy research. And around that time, the Republicans had taken over Congress in 1994. Newt Gingrich, Speaker of the House, pushed the Contract with America, one of the planks of which, as many will recall, was this massive overhaul to so-called welfare programs, specifically cash welfare, what used to be called AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, what later, after the reform was passed, became TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. But at that time, this is before the welfare reform had passed, the Congress was taking up that issue and was planning on sending a bill to President Clinton for him to either sign or to veto. And then either way, you know, the right was going to use that, I suppose, as a political chit of some sort. And one of the things that we were doing as an advocacy organization for poor families was we were lobbying against this particular welfare reform. We knew that if this thing became law, it was going to ultimately hurt millions of poor people. In that particular moment, it probably wouldn't hurt too many because the economy was doing relatively well. But we knew that the economy would, in fact, take a downturn as it did, and that when it did, a lot of people were going to be harmed because this welfare reform bill was going to essentially convert the cash program into block grants that would be given to the states. The amount of money would be frozen at 1996 levels with only very small adjustments for inflation, which would essentially mean that over the years, years, the per recipient value of benefits would either decline substantially, or you'd have to dramatically slash the number of people being served, and you'd have to do that whether the economy was good or bad. There was no flexibility built in for economic downturns, right? It was just a block grant, fixed amount of money, do with it what you will, good luck. And we knew that in good times that might work, in bad times that was going to hurt a lot of folks. And ultimately we were right, of course, if you follow it out into the time of the recession and even still today. But as we're lobbying against this thing, one of the things that I was tasked with doing was going on the radio in New Orleans and throughout the state and making the case for why this legislation was bad and why people should oppose it and why they should call their congressperson and why they should call their senators and, you know, whatever. And I would go on this one particular program in New Orleans where the host was very favorable to our position on this. She was one of only a handful of progressive talk show hosts in the city at that time. Most of them were just sort of Rush Limbaugh knockoffs. So she had me on several times to talk about this particular issue. I remember the first time I went, I took with me all these note cards. And again, this was the debater in me, sort of laid them out around the desk where I was going to be sitting on the other side of the microphones from where the host was sitting. And I just laid out all my facts and I had all my stuff in a particular order where I knew, right, that if a caller called in, because we're going to take calls, if a caller called in and challenged me on something, then by God, I knew exactly where to look on the desk. I knew exactly which fact to pick up, and I knew exactly which statistical data point I was going to use to put this caller back in their place, right? And so this happened multiple times. We did the show. The host and I had a great conversation. Everything was fine. About 25, 30 minutes in, we go to the phones. And, you know, there are a few calls that are supportive and great. And then came the inevitable sort of hostile, well, let me tell you about poor people calls, or let me tell you about those lazy welfare bums, whatever. And so, you know, you'd have the predictable statements, right? They'd call and say, well, these people would just stop having babies out of wedlock, blah, 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 blah. And then I would reach over and I'd pull out the index card that says actually the number of children in the typical quote unquote welfare family really isn't any different in Louisiana or anywhere in the country from the typical non-welfare family. One of the reasons for that is that in most states, and at that time, Louisiana certainly included, the extra amount of money that you got for having an additional child came to something like $13 a week, I think, $52 a month or something. Even with food stamp increase, it would be like $100, $110, $120 a month. Not enough to feed a family, not enough to really pay for that extra child. But all these people seem to think that, you know, oh, there's this huge incentive to just keep having babies, you know, as if somehow women are just like, oh, shit, I think I'll just do 9 months of pregnancy and labor for that $52 a month. What do you say? That sounds like a great deal, right? This is how little we think of women and how little we think of poor women. And let's be honest, how little we think of poor women of color who were the ones typified as the recipients of these programs, which was another myth. People would call and say, it's all the blacks. And then I'd pull out my card that says, no, actually, you know, most of the recipients are white. And, you know, so we just go round and round like this, whether it was about the out of wedlock childbirths, whether it was about the racial makeup of the recipients, whether it was about how much money they got, whatever it was, whether it was about, oh, these women have been on welfare for five generations. And then I'd pull out my evidence that said, no, that's bullshit, too. Typical person on assistance is off within a year to 18 months. 83% of the people, I think the number used to be 83% of the folks who get welfare as adults did not get welfare as children, you know, on and on and on. And from a debater's perspective, every time I did this, I won. From a debater's perspective, there was nothing that I could not shut down. So in any sort of objective scale of winning or losing the argument, I won every argument. Like, I'm not even bragging when I say that. It's not like it was even hard, right? I came prepared. I came with the appropriate ammunition. But then at the end of that program, the last caller of the day is this white guy who calls in and says, well, you know what they say, liars always figure and figures always lie. And then he just hung up the phone. And I just remember looking at the host and looking down at my notes and thinking, holy shit. What I just learned in this moment is that my whole way of looking at this, which is, let me show you how much I know and how much more I know than you and actually how many facts I have and you don't have any and I win. I just came to realize how none of that shit mattered at all. Like, essentially, that was only going to matter to the people who were probably already sort of amenable to my position. But the person who was on the other side, who I was at least theoretically trying to persuade on the radio, really was just like, well, whatever. Liars always figure, meaning we always use numbers to distort the evidence. And figures, that is to say data and numbers, always lie. It's that whole, you know, you can make numbers say whatever you want. Well, no, you actually can't. That's not how math works. But people believe that. Well, you can just make data say anything. And, you know, sort of this is that mentality that we now see completely ratified in this country with the whole notion of alternative facts, or Rudy Giuliani this week saying truth isn't truth. It's Donald Trump saying a couple weeks ago to his supporters at that rally, what you're seeing and what you're reading isn't real. Only thing that's real is what I'm telling you, right? It's this notion that truth is just whatever the hell you want it to be. And sadly, that was the opinion of this caller, and I realized he was not likely to be alone. Fast forward again to the year 2000. I write a piece that was online. This is, you know, in the days before social media. It was in the days before, I don't know, there wasn't even Google yet. There were just websites. We didn't even really have blogs. We just had websites. And I was writing for Z Magazine's online presence at the time. And I wrote a piece about Confederate monuments. This was back in 2000. And, you know, this debate has been around for a very long time. I think this was around the time that it first became an issue in the South Carolina State House. And, so I wrote a piece about why I thought the Confederate flags needed to come down off these state houses. I talked about it both from a historical perspective. I talked about it as a Southerner. I talked about it, obviously, as a symbol of racism and enslavement, and tried to document, I think effectively, in fact, the fact that the Confederate cause, according to the Confederate leaders themselves, was the maintenance of white supremacy and the enslavement of people of African descent. They admitted it at the time. I mean, it, you know, they didn't have any shame or pretension about it. They didn't feel in any way self-conscious about it. They were quite open about it. We lie now because we've learned that that's sort of, you know, you're not supposed to believe that kind of shit. But back in the day, they really didn't have any compunction. So they pretty much said it. And so I documented in the piece, and this piece went semi-viral. By today's standards, it would not be viral, but by those standards, it was pretty viral. It got tens of thousands of views on the website, and I started getting a shit ton of emails in response. Again, some of them supportive, but a huge number coming from, you know, the League of the South and the Sons of Confederate Veterans and the whatever, all these neo-Confederate Southerners who I've grown up around all my life. You see them with their bumper stickers. I love the one, just as a side note, there's a sticker you see every now and then that'll have a picture of the Confederate flag, and it'll say, "If I'd have known this would happen, I'd have picked my own cotton." And of course, the person who has that dumbass sticker on their car wants you to believe, I'm quite confident, that that flag and the Confederate cause had nothing to do with slavery. And if you asked them, they had nothing to do with that. But then they have a sticker that basically refers to picking cotton. And if he'd known that would have happened, which, I mean, I guess means what? The emancipation of black people? What? Civil rights? What? Multiculturalism? That he'd have done it himself. Well, it's sort of hard to convince me that it wasn't about picking cotton and the enslavement of those who did the cotton picking when you put that shit right there on the bumper of your truck. So I write this piece and I start getting these hostile emails. And this one comes to me from a guy in South Carolina, a student, or at least claims to be, at the University of South Carolina. And it was bizarre in a lot of ways. Like, he's going off about, well, you're from Nashville, because I mentioned in the piece that I was. He says, you're from Nashville. What, you probably like that Vanderbilt bunch of sissies. They can't play football. That's not real football. SEC football is South Carolina Gamecocks and Alabama Crimson Tide and blah, 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 and Auburn and Florida, and y'all are just a bunch of pansies. Well, first of all, I didn't go to Vanderbilt. I fully realize that Vanderbilt historically has been a basement-dwelling team within the Southeastern Conference, and I also don't give a shit. Like, I have no investment in your criticism of Vanderbilt. I guess, like, these guys, you know, for whom, like, you know, Saturday football, football and tailgating parties, football is their whole life. Like, the only reason they went to college was for game day. I just went for game day, man. Just got tailgating and parties and shit and football, right? Like, they're happy for, you know, those 11 or 12 games 14, 15 weeks it takes to play them. And then I guess they're just like unhappy the rest of the year. Like, well, I can drop out now, right? But so this cat writes to me, and he's going off about Vanderbilt football. And I try to steer the conversation back to the shit where we started, which was about the Confederate flag. And after we go around and around and around for a little bit, I explained to him, I thought in relatively easy to understand terms. I didn't get real scholarly and academic on his ass. I just pointed out, listen, you know, the problem with you defending the Confederacy is that you're defending a bunch of folks who believed in the exploitation of black labor. And I went through a long sort of explanation, not really that long, medium length explanation of how that actually hurt white labor. The vast majority of white working class piss poor folks were actually hurt by that system because it bids the wage base downward, right? If I can get enslaved persons to work for me for free, you know, because I own them, even though the initial investment of buying them on the auction block might set me back a minute, I make that up relatively quickly. And it's cheaper in the long run than having to hire your white ass and pay you a dollar a day or whatever it might take, or hire a bunch of white working class folks to work on the same plantation or work in the blacksmith shop or cook my food or whatever it is, you know, that I'd have to pay for. And so I went through this long explanation of how the exploitation of black bodies and black labor ultimately bids down the wages of vast majority of white working class people, which this guy identified himself as and coming from a long line of such. And by the time I was done explaining that, he wrote me back, and this was our last exchange. He wrote me back and he said, well, you know, you're probably right. You make a good point. However, and this is once again where you get to the point you realize facts don't matter. He says, however, I'd be willing to work for only a dollar an hour if we could just go back to the good old days of segregation. If we could just go back to the way things were, I'd work for a dollar an hour. In other words, he was acknowledging that the system of white supremacy was actually, in absolute terms, harmful for working class white people. But what he was saying was, I don't even care. I'd be willing to be even poorer than I am. I'd be willing to work for a dollar an hour. What is that? $8 a day. What? $40 a week. If we could just go back to the time when I and people like me were on top, unquestioned in our superiority. That is what W.E.B. Du Bois, the great sociologist, called the psychological wage of whiteness, right? And there it is in real time. I mean, this dude writing to me and basically saying, you're totally right on the facts. You're totally right on the history. You're totally right on the economics. And I just don't care because I just want to feel better than somebody. All of that means that facts in and of themselves are just not going to suffice. And that's something that's really hard for people on the left to hear. It's probably hard for people on the right too, to some extent, especially like the libertarian end of the right, because both libertarians and Marxists, ironically, given that they, you know, are so different in so many ways, both the sort of free market worshiping libertarian end of conservatism and sort of the Marxist end of the left, both, I think, overassume that facts and reason and rationality matter. So the libertarian says, well, we need a free market, right? Because in a free market, people will make the right decisions and people are rational actors and they'll weigh their various options and they'll choose the thing that's best for them. And then the Marxist says, well, ultimately, working class people will come to realize and develop class consciousness because they will come to see the contradictions of the system. They'll come to see that they should function as a class because they are exploited as a class. And so they will act rationally and rise up to overthrow capitalism. And both of these positions overassume that people are rational beings, if not all the time, certainly most of the time, right? But the reality is we're not. It's not just that dude that wrote to me in response to the Confederate flag piece, or the one who tried to shut me down on the radio, or the people in Lafayette around the David Duke thing. It's not just that they're irrational. Most of us are not, right? We engage in impulse purchases at the grocery store. That's why they put the chocolate at the checkout counter, y'all. It's not because there was a bunch of extra chocolate and they didn't have somewhere to put it. They put that shit up there on purpose, knowing that you came to the grocery hungry, even though they tell you don't ever do that, and you get up there and you got all the food you wanted to get and all the stuff your family really needed, and then you're like, holy hell, I need a payday bar or whatever the hell, right? That's not rational behavior, but we do it. We Google our health symptoms rather than going to a doctor. And not just because we don't have the money for the doctor, but because we think somehow we're going to find a diagnosis that's accurate on a Reddit thread, you know, whose moderator is Kombucha Katie 411, you know, or Chia Seed Charlie is going to tell us what's wrong with us. We don't want to go to a doctor. We'll just check that shit out on a thread somewhere. Or, you know, you see people gambling when they're broke, they're down to their last money and they're going and gambling, figuring, okay, this is the spin of the slot machine where I'm going to hit it rich, or they're playing the lottery in spite of the absolutely ridiculous odds that they're going to win. And they'll say things like, well, you can't win if you don't play. Like what is that? Doesn't even mean anything, right? I mean, it's true, you know, but it's like saying, well, I can't get hit by lightning if I don't go outside. Well, that's true too. But what exactly is the point of the statement, right? But it's irrational behavior, and we all do it to some extent or another. Indeed, the recent research over the last 15 to 20 years is very clear. Facts, data, rational proof typically fails to win many converts politically or ideologically, or influence our political behavior. Our political ideologies are largely the result of certain experiences that we've had, and the way that we make sense of those experiences, and the way we make sense of those experiences has a lot to do with our upbringing. It has a lot to do with the environment within which we're having those experiences. So if we're raised in somewhat isolated communities where we don't have a lot of contact with people who are different than ourselves, the odds of us developing a sort of provincial worldview, a very insular worldview, being suspicious of outsiders, makes a lot of sense. It's probably going to happen. It's not going to happen for everyone in that situation. Just like being open to difference and nuance isn't going to happen just because you grew up in a metropolitan, cosmopolitan community. But there are correlations between these things that have very little to do with facts or with rationality. It has to do with the stories we are told and the stories we tell, our personal experiences, our family. In fact, there are even some studies which suggest, as frightening as this may seem, that some of this is biologically hardwired, that there are biological predilections and predispositions towards more conservative versus more liberal, in big picture terms, because I know those are very broad terms. There are even some biological predispositions, not so controlling that they can't be overcome or changed, but that do lead us in a certain direction. And when they interact with a cultural influence or environmental influence that furthers that biological predilection, then the odds of us ending up in the direction of both the biology and the environmental influence is incredibly good. It is hard to change a worldview after many years of having had it, because at some point, your identity is bound up with your position. It could be a faith position as a person of a particular religion. It could be something central to how you conceive of yourself or of the world. And the longer that you find yourself in that space, I mean, just logically, the harder it is to get someone to change that worldview. Just giving them facts that challenge their very sense of self is just as likely to cause pushback as it is to cause conversion. Like, when was the last time you were in a political argument with someone and you busted out a bunch of facts on them and, you know, basically showed them the error of their ways and just what an idiot they were? And they were like, holy hell, I am such a dumbass. Let me completely get rid of the last 45 years of my life in terms of how I think about the world. That has just never happened in my experience or the experience of anyone I've ever heard. And so, you know, it's just hard. And we need to understand that, because if we're interested in making change in the world, if we're interested in persuading people to vote for certain candidates or to vote for us if we're the candidate, or we're trying to persuade people to join certain movements, if you're trying to convince people that you're right, the question then becomes, how do you do that? And the evidence seems to say facts and data and proof, as we tend to think of it, quantitative, verifiable proof, just isn't really the way that it happens. In the modern world, we are a lot less like debaters and more like cheerleaders. And the people who act like the cheerleaders, or maybe the pep club would be the better analogy here, the better metaphor, they tend to get further than the debate team. Maybe that was always true, and I just didn't want to admit it. You know, one of those things, or two of them, the cheerleaders and the pep club, they make you feel good. And the debaters challenge you to think more deeply and maybe even challenge your own thoughts, and might inadvertently cause you to think that you're being judged for not being as smart as the debaters. And frankly, humans would rather feel good than struggle with complexity. It's very natural. Humans would rather feel good and be affirmed in who they are than to be challenged in who they are. So when I bust out a bunch of facts on you, in effect, what I'm saying, or at least what the person hears oftentimes, is you're an idiot. How can you be so stupid? Don't you know? Blah, 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 blah. And most people people, you know, shocker, don't like being told that they're idiots. It's a lot more fun to call someone an idiot. Trust me, I do it a lot. It's a lot more fun to do that than it is to have that done to you, right? So the question is, what do we do with this information? And it seems to me our choices are somewhat limited. We can either switch to less fact-based methods of persuasion, like narrative and storytelling, or we can sort of give up on persuasion and just focus on mobilization. Let's look at those one at a time, right? The idea of changing to less fact-based methods of persuasion, like narrative and storytelling. Think about what Trump has done. Donald Trump is not president because he went forward with a bunch of data and facts and analysis. Every time he wades into the world of data and facts and analysis and history, he gets it wrong. But he's a very good storyteller, right? The story is about good and noble people who have been laid low by the bad people who threaten them. Those might be Muslims. It might be immigrants. It's Mexicans coming across the border who are rapists and drug dealers. And maybe some of them are good people, whatever it was he said, right? But, you know, he makes that story, right? It's very much about the good people and the bad people, and he's going to give the story a fairy tale ending, a good and a happy ending for the good people. Barack Obama was a storyteller. He didn't become president either. I don't want this to sound partisan. Barack Obama didn't become president because he went forth with a bunch of facts and data and analysis and a keen command of history, even though he has all of those at his disposal. That's not how he became president, instilling a bunch of data points and statistics in the minds of millions of voters. No, he told a story. And the story was a story about a nation becoming itself, a story that was about a nation that was constantly changing and improving and becoming a better and more complete nation. And to some extent, he visually, symbolically, as a man of color, represented that story in the flesh, both to people of color and to just enough white folks to allow him to win. George W. Bush, before that, and Bill Clinton, I would point out, both told a story, very effective, about just regular guys. They had Southern accents, they had sort of an aw shucks mentality, and that was counterpositioned against the out-of-touch elitism of their opponents. So in the case of George W. Bush, he painted, what, John Kerry as this elitist who goes windsurfing and, you know, whatever. Of course, you know, George W. Bush, when he ran in 2000 against Gore, also played that game a little bit, and Gore got in trouble during the debates, if you recall, for rolling his eyes and sort of huffing and puffing and looking down at Bush. And there were people, granted, the Supreme Court handed the White House to Bush, so let's be clear about that, right? But the reason that Bush was even in that contest at all was because there was this appeal based on his aw shucks mentality, I'm just a normal guy, blah, 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 even though, you know, his family, and this is this political dynasty, it's an incredibly wealthy family, he's not from Texas, he's from Connecticut, for God's sake, but he told a story. And it was a very effective story, much more effective than Gore's, much more effective than Kerry's. Bill Clinton, you know, was able to paint George Bush the first as being out of touch because he didn't know what the little price scanners at the grocery store were or whatever, right? So he's out of touch. And Clinton had this story about being born in a, I don't know, in a pile of shit in Hope, Arkansas, or whatever. I don't remember the story, right? But it was basically he's born in an outhouse, you know, and oh my gosh, and he's just a normal guy, and I'd love to have a beer with him or whatever, or eat some barbecue, because, you know, that's apparently what people are looking for. That was what it was. Ronald Reagan was a storyteller, man. That's how he became president. And yet there were a lot of people, particularly in Clinton's team, James Carville, for example, and George Stephanopoulos, who still to this day, I gather, believe that Bill Clinton won because of the facts, because it's the economy, stupid. So we'll just make everybody realize how much they're hurting, and that's how we're going to win. Well, first of all, there's just no evidence that that's why Bill Clinton became president. The reason Bill Clinton's president is Ross Perot was in the race. I mean, let's be real clear on this. If Ross Perot is not in the race, the odds are incredibly good that Bill Clinton does not become president, even though for millions of people, the economy was sucking wind at about that moment. So we can sit there and act like it was the facts and people had this deep understanding of their pocketbook needs. But the whole history of America is the history of people ignoring their pocketbook needs for other issues, whether that was their religious beliefs around abortion or in the modern era around LGBT equality, whether that's white working class people ignoring their economic needs to maintain their racial position. I mean, that's the history of American politics. So the idea that people are actually out there making their voting decision on the basis of their so-called rational self-interest is belied by the entire history of American politics and now is disproven by the social psychological research. So people still believe it, but it's not true. Humans are wired evolutionarily, apparently, to respond to stories. And the problem is those of us on the left, I fear, have long since abandoned storytelling in favor of academic and scientific methods, which don't appear to work very well in the political realm. They're really good for getting tenure. So, you know, keep at it when you're in the academy, I suppose. But it's pretty off-putting to people who are still yearning for a good story. On the other hand, the right tells really good stories. Stories that are rooted in religion and faith, stories that are rooted in what's called teleological reasoning. That's a phrase you should not use, by the way, with average everyday, you know, voters on the campaign trail, because it sounds academic-y. But teleological reasoning is, you know, this notion that things happen for a reason, and you can discern that reason by looking at the outcome of something and then working backwards, right? So if a tragedy comes into our lives, as it does for all of us, that must have been ordained. It was for a purpose. And then later on, if things get better, well, maybe the tragedy was necessary to bring us to a place where it's now better, which means suffering isn't bad. Maybe it's a necessary step to something better. And we believe that stuff because that's a lot easier, even though, again, there's no evidence for it. That's just it's a manner of reasoning that we use. That's a lot easier than accepting the possibility that things could be random, that things could just happen and maybe not have a reason. Because once you accept that, right, that's very frightening. It means you're not totally in control, or that God is not in control, or that karma is not in control, that just bad shit could just happen and there might not be any purpose. But isn't that obvious? I mean, if you say things like, well, everything happens for a reason, then you have to explain the reason behind mass starvation. You need to explain to me why there are billions of people, not millions, but billions of people on the planet that don't have enough nutrition to survive for extended periods of time. I need to know the moral, philosophical, logical, religious, theological reason why you believe that that bullshit happened. It just doesn't make sense. And everybody's got a reason why these horrible things happen to people, because we need reasons. People crave order, right? Faith provides order, as do stories about good and evil that have happy endings. And it's also why people gravitate to conspiracy theories, right? It's a way to understand the world that you don't fully understand. It's a way to understand why bad things happen, even to good people. Because at least if events are being manipulated, then there's a chance that if we can just expose the manipulators, then we'll be safe. If we just find out who the bad guys are, if we could just uncover Oz, then bad things will stop happening. But if we don't believe that, if we accept that actually maybe there is no Oz, if we do that, that means we're rudderless. We're at risk. Our kids could literally get shot at school tomorrow, God forbid, or we could go to work and planes might fly into our buildings and we might die and never see our children again. Or, you know, your child might simply end up having autism for reasons we don't fully understand, but it sure as shit is not the vaccines. But accepting that means that the world is one of chaos, and that is scary to us because we have a sense of our own mortality. And having a sense of your own mortality, if you accept chaos, that means, holy shit, I could literally die like in the next 10 minutes. Oh my God, there's no predictability. And I get it, it's frightening. But ultimately, the left, I think, responds to this by trying to use reason to fight faith. But there's a reason that the Bible is the best-selling book of all time. There's a reason that spiritual writings and religion have lasted for so much time. It's not because there's facts behind it. It's because faith is more visceral and it is more powerful, and it connects to something that is uniquely human that I think sometimes reason and rationality don't fully comprehend or appreciate. That's not to say that we ought to give ourselves over to just blind faith, but you better understand faith and have a healthy respect for it as a human tendency if you want to figure out how to speak to people. The other alternative as a way to persuade, rather than focusing on facts, is to abandon persuasion altogether and reduce politics to brute power and brute force. I don't necessarily mean violent force. I mean the force of political mobilization. This is also something the right has done. In addition to narrative and storytelling, they have also done the mobilization thing far better than the left. And it's been a conscious strategy. I'll just take it back to, you know, 30 years. In the late 80s, I think it was 88 or 89, Ralph Reed, who was the head of the Christian Coalition, one of the big evangelical fundamentalist religious right lobbying organizations, he is famous for having said that it wasn't necessary for the religious right to get the majority of Americans on their side. He understood that was never going to happen. It was never going to be 50% plus one, but it did not need to be. All they needed, he said, it was either 6% or 9%. It was something really small like that. Between 6 and 9% of the American population, if they were committed to that religious right worldview, that would be enough, because the rest of the country would be at home watching Falcon Crest, which for younger folks, that was a very, very popular television show. The argument being most people are just sort of amusing themselves to to death, and they're not paying attention to this stuff. And so if we've got a small coterie of people who are really committed to our worldview, we're going to win. We're going to be a minority. We're going to be a distinct minority, but we're going to be enough. And I think the left doesn't, you know, liberals and the left want 50% plus one. We want everybody to see what we see. And I guess there's a democratic impulse there, small d, democratic impulse, not the party, but the notion of democracy. Because the democracy-minded person does not want to run roughshod over people and impose their will on people. The person who believes in democracy wants everybody to come along and see the greatness of this, and then we'll vote for it, and we'll all feel good about the fact that it was, you know, ratified by the majority. But the reality is that's not really the way politics works. It's never been the way that politics work, and the way that the right operates, they understand that. And this is all not to say that there isn't a role for facts. Please don't misunderstand. It's not that it's not helpful to know facts, but maybe the purpose of facts and the importance of them is not the reason you think. Maybe it's not to sheep steal, that is to say, from one congregation to the next, using another religious metaphor. But maybe it's about animating your own flock, even if your congregation only grows by a little bit, right? If we think of it in terms of churches within a town, got a bunch of different churches. They all have half full pews on Sunday, right? Most churches not full on Sunday. They got another church right across town preaching the same Bible, but a slightly different twist, and they got third of the house full. The first place had half the house full. Next place down the road has a quarter of the house full. But rather than come together, they're all, you know, they're all doing their own thing. Well, church number one can try to steal sheep from church number two, which can try to steal sheep from church number three, so to speak, and increase the size of their congregation. Or they can just make sure that the people in their congregation are more mobilized for whatever the hell it is they're fighting for than the people in the other churches, or the people who are home, metaphorically speaking, watching Falcon Crest or America's Got Talent or whatever it is they're watching and not doing anything at all. So facts matter. It just might not be for the purpose of conversion. It might be for the purpose of mobilization. And this is a really important point because, you know, I don't want people to believe that when they're trying to build movements or you're trying to, you know, persuade someone about a particular issue or even a particular candidate, that you don't want to use facts at all, or that facts are so irrelevant that we shouldn't learn the facts about different issues and only deal with narratives and only deal with storytelling. You do need to understand the issues that you're talking about and use facts and information, but more as a mobilization tool, as a shot in the arm for your own side than perhaps as a sheep-stealing conversion tool. And I can actually give you an example of how I think this works and why it's important. Back when I started college, I was already politically liberal. I had a pretty, I guess, for a 17-year-old, a relatively advanced understanding of contemporary issues because I had been a debater. And so I had to research things that your typical 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old would not have been researching. So I probably knew more than a lot of folks, but I still didn't have always the courage of my convictions when it came to various issues. So I could tell you, for instance, when I started college, that if you'd asked me, hey, do you support affirmative action? I would have said yes. And I would have had some very general understanding of why. I would have probably been able to tell you that because of the history of racial discrimination against Black and brown folks, and particularly African Americans, that there was a moral and practical obligation to, you know, provide targeted opportunity to people who have been left out. But it would have been a very generic defense. It would have been a defense that wasn't necessarily coming from a place of clarity and confidence, because I really hadn't delved into the issue a whole lot enough to where I knew all the permutations and the ins and outs of why the critique of affirmative action was wrong. It was only after I took a particular class, and one of the things that was, this is back in the day, I don't know if they still do this, back in the day you had, you know, what we used to call Kinko's packets, right? Which was just a packet of reading materials that had been literally copied at the Kinko's, and you would pay, you know, X amount of dollars for it rather than a particular standard textbook. And so in the Kinko's packet were like four chapters, maybe five chapters from a book, which I later read the entire book of, but at the time, just four or five chapters of a book called Equality by a psychologist named William Ryan. Ryan, famous for a book he had written before then called Blaming the Victim, which came out in the early 1970s and was looking specifically at the way that this society tends to blame poor people for their poverty. The book Equality, which was sort of his follow-up to Blaming the Victim, came out in 1981, as I recall. and it looked at sort of the philosophical premises of the sort of limited state, libertarian, free market worshiping conservatives, the Milton Friedman types, who at that particular moment were ascendant in the incoming Reagan administration. And there was a section in there about affirmative action. And really, the argument that Ryan was making was one that said that, you know, real equal opportunity, true equal opportunity, actually requires these interventions on behalf of Black folks, and here's why. And he went into great detail philosophically, logically, analytically, factually, historically. And by the time I was done reading this chapter from Ryan's book, I had a much different and deeper understanding of my perspective. Now, I'm not saying everyone would have that reaction, right? My guess is, again, based on what I've been talking about this whole hour, that someone who was firmly committed in the other direction against affirmative action probably isn't going to be flipped by reading that chapter from William Ryan's book, nor are they going to be flipped years later reading my book on affirmative action, which I ultimately wrote in 2005, called Affirmative Action, Racial Preference in Black and White. I make a lot of the same arguments Ryan makes. I use a lot of facts, a lot of history, you know, tons of evidence. My guess is if you were really deeply committed to an anti-affirmative action position, you could read Ryan, you could read me, you're probably still going to be in that space. Might be able to soften you up a little bit, but probably not going to flip you altogether. On the other hand, if you're someone who is like I was when I read that chapter from Ryan's book, and you sort of support affirmative action, you think you know why, but maybe you're not totally confident about it, I think reading that chapter or reading my book or reading or hearing a speaker that, you know, gives that unapologetic defense of affirmative action or any other policy issue could be the thing that turns you from sort of a passive liberal, progressive, knows what they know, feels what they feel, maybe votes every 4 years or every 2 years for Congress, but doesn't necessarily go out there and advocate, doesn't actually go out there and do much to move the dial, could turn you from that person into someone who has the courage of their convictions and as a result is actually more active. So getting mobilized, getting the courage of your conviction is like getting a shot of adrenaline. It may not change the person who's on the other side, but if it mobilizes the people who are at least lukewarm on your own side, in political terms, electoral terms, or whatever else, or movement building terms, that makes all the difference in the world. Having someone who's a passive supporter of an idea because they don't have the courage of their convictions yet, because they don't know the facts and they don't have the analysis and they don't know how to respond to the other side's arguments, makes you far less effective than someone who has the courage of their convictions, knows the arguments, knows the facts, and therefore, frankly, becomes a more effective advocate. Yes, maybe facts don't matter in the traditional sense. They don't matter in the sense of changing you from one position to the next, but they can definitely inoculate sort of fence sitters against maybe the worst of the other side's arguments, and they can mobilize your own side. It's also important to realize that even if we're not going to rely principally on facts when we're out there making the case for our political movements or for candidates that we like, that facts can hurt you when they are used badly. Facts may not help you with your adversaries. They may only help you with mobilizing your own base, but they can definitely hurt you when you use them badly, because anyone on the other side will be looking for that weakness. And if you use a fact in an irresponsible way, people are going to pounce on that. And frankly, that happens all the time. It is not just the right which demonstrates a propensity for using statistics badly, using facts badly. Our side does it as well. Let me give you a few examples of what I mean. Because I see this done all the time, and it drives me nuts, because I know that the enemies of racial justice and equity will use this against you when you use this data badly. So when you hear people say, for instance, the typical white household has X percent more income each year than the typical Black household. And so that's obviously racism. And if there were no racism, the household incomes would be the same. That is an absolutely ignorant argument. And it's not because racism doesn't explain a significant amount of income differences between white folks and people of color. It does. But that one statistical fact alone does not prove that. To suggest that household income disparities between whites and blacks in and of themselves prove racism without any other analysis, without any other data, is ridiculous because of a couple of things. Number one, as the right is always fond of pointing out, usually for horribly cynical and manipulative purposes, Black households are much more likely than white households to be single-parent households. Now, those of us on the left might respond to that by saying, well, yes, but there are reasons for that having to do with the underemployability of black men who have been criminalized and disproportionately incarcerated, and that's one of the reasons that two-parent households don't form. Other people might say, yes, well, there's a history of enslavement breaking up the black family. But putting aside all of the reasons why the household sizes are different, let's just understand at the statistical level, the mere fact that white households are more likely to have two people as parents and two income earners, and black households are more likely to be single parent with one household income earner, by definition is going to explain a big difference in household income. Single parent homes tend to earn less than two parent homes. That doesn't mean that the household income disparities aren't in part about racism, but you have to do more than just say that one piece of data. What you have to do is you want to compare single-parent families with single-parent families, because when you do that, you compare white single-parent homes and black single-parent homes. The white single-parent homes are usually much better off. The black single-parent homes, much more likely to be poor, far less household income, even when you're comparing apples and apples. So that allows us to then say, hey, now racism could explain a significant portion, perhaps, of that disparity. Same thing when you look at two-parent households. You can look at, for instance, your typical African-American young couple. So just out of college, sort of starting married couple. By the mid-90s, and this probably has gotten worse since the recession, but as of the mid to late 90s already, was starting off with about one-fifth the household wealth of a similar white family just out of college, young, two-parent, married couple. The black families were starting out at a significant disadvantage, not just in terms of income, but even more in terms of wealth. Why? Because they weren't as likely to have had any inheritance from family or intergenerational wealth transfer. They weren't as likely to get their college paid for, so they were more likely to start out in debt. They weren't as likely to get down payment assistance on their first home, so they're having to go deeper into debt just to start out. That stuff is a good comparison. That's a kind of comparison where you're looking at apples and apples. But if you're using data where you're just saying white households, black households, and you're not accounting for the difference in the size of the households, you're using data badly and it's going to be used against you. By the same token, if you say black folks are only, 13% of the population, but 50% of the people on death row, and that proves racism, you're once again using data badly. There are some other steps that you need to put in. Those steps are, by the way, available to you, but a lot of people don't even bother. They say, well, if blacks are 13% of the population, they should be 13% of the people in prison or on death row. Well, that only is true if you assume that people commit crime in direct proportion to their numbers in the population. But no legitimate progressive or leftist should assume that's true, because by definition, those of us on the left, I hope we know, the studies certainly indicated all around the world, that people who are disproportionately poor and lower income and economically strapped have a higher rate of crime. So by definition, if black folks are, as they are, historically and still today, 2.5 to 3.5 times more likely than whites to be poor, and far more likely, 6 to 7 times more likely to live in concentrated poverty neighborhoods, which we know around the world are especially likely to be correlated with higher rates of offending, then by definition, the black criminal offending rate is going to be more than 13%. So you can't say that this group ought to be 13% of the people locked up because they're 13% of the population, because they're not just 13% of the desperately poor. They are a far higher number than that. So you have to then look at the data more deeply. The data on incarceration does, when you dig deeper, indicate real disparity, particularly with regard to the war on drugs, particularly with regard to the length of sentence that's given out by juries, 20% longer sentences for the same crime with the same background factors, according to one recent study. Juvenile offenders, 6 times more likely to be sent to jail rather than some type of diversionary program when they are arrested for a first offense if they're black, as opposed to if they're white, even when all the other factors are the same. I mean, that's real data. But simply looking at the aggregate statistics is not sufficient. And the reason this is important is because Barack Obama had a horrible tendency, as intelligent as he obviously is and as knowledgeable as he is about the way that white racial framing and white racial attitudes have tended to work in our society, he would do this a lot, where he would just present the data on poverty differences or educational dropout differences or income differences or incarceration differences or whatever it was in sort of an abstract way, or even like the data on not having health care. And he would point out that in all these different indicators, white folks were better off and black folks were worse off. But if you do not go behind that fact and provide clear evidence to indicate, hey, the reason for this is because of unfairness, and here's some examples of it, and here's the proof of it, then what you leave people with is just the fact of inequality itself. The problem being, in our society, when we hear about inequality, we tend to rationalize it because we are told, as part of the secular gospel of America, that wherever you end up is basically all about you. So if you work hard, you can make it. If you didn't make it, it's your own damn fault. So if you tell me here are poor people and here are rich people, putting race completely to the side for a second, or you say to me, here's white folks, here's black folks, and you think that the fact of the inequality itself is going to convince me to be sympathetic and to want to do something, you're ignoring the fact that every other thing in my society is telling me that I don't have to be sympathetic, that I don't have to give a shit about that, because we all end up where we deserve to be. So if you're going to present data that says this group is worse off on this particular indicator, you had better come behind that and provide some context. That context could be evidence of disparate treatment by law enforcement or by teachers, or it could be stories that illustrate disparate treatment, or it could be both, but you can't just put facts out in the abstract because they backfire. If you don't introduce a narrative about unfairness, and that could be data, that could be analysis, that could be narrative, it could be all three, but if you leave that piece out and you just present facts in the abstract, that is when it doesn't work. So maybe I guess what I'm saying is the lesson of all this research is not that facts don't matter at all. It's that facts do matter, but they matter in maybe narrower ways than we've believed. They matter more as a way to give adrenaline to your side and mobilization to your side than they do to convert others. And whenever you're going to present them, make sure you are presenting them in a way that gives the context behind them so as to lead people to your interpretation and find either the facts or the story or both that are going to bridge the gap between point A, the facts that you're offering in the abstract, and point maybe D, where the person to whom you're speaking suddenly clicks with what it is you're saying and begins to support your worldview and your analysis. Really, the ultimate thing here is that we on the left have to get better at the two things that the right has always been incredibly good at. Number one is storytelling, which we can do by taking every fact that we normally like to bandy about, every bit of statistical data, every argument and analysis that we like to make, and figure out what's a story that illustrates this. So that if we're going to use the statistic, or we're going to use the data, or we're going to point to the study, so be it. But have a story that you can use to illustrate and make visual in someone's brain the fact that you're trying to express, right? So when you're talking about the war on drugs, you can either provide a lot of data to prove the disparity, or you can tell a story about your own life or someone's life whose story you know that demonstrates the unfairness of the war on drugs. I do this in my work. I talk about my own ability as someone who used to get high on a regular basis to be able to do so without much fear of arrest, as opposed to other people I know who got high far less than I did, who ended up being busted for drugs, right? Or being at least suspected of using drugs even when they weren't. Those stories actually stick with my audiences, I know, far longer than the data. I give the data because I want the people in the audience who are reachable with data, or who are mobilizable, if you will, with data and by data, to have the data. But the story is what really ultimately is going to matter. So we need to get better at that. And then secondly, get better at mobilizing our side. Spend less time trying to convert everyone else. Spend less time worrying about your racist uncle at Thanksgiving. You know, just have turkey or whatever it is you're eating. Just talk to your uncle about TV if you need to. Talk to your uncle about sports. And if you have to talk to your uncle or whomever it is about politics, ask questions, tell stories, offer your view, and be prepared to listen to that person's view and take in what it is they're saying, so that even if you don't change them at the Thanksgiving table. And I got news for you. You're not going to. At least you will gain some insight into what makes that person tick. You'll be able to offer, hopefully, by virtue of some storytelling, insight into what makes you tick. And worst case scenario is you go away from that Thanksgiving table a little less angry, a little less adversarial, a little less ideologically and politically tribal than you were when you came in. And if that's all that happens, that would be a significant improvement for our political culture. And that'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Join us again next week and every Tuesday, and you can also check out my essays at medium.com or my website, www.timwise.org, and follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram. Take care, and stop by again next week.
And the righteous.